Very good, thank you. Now we have questions, I guess my first question is, what would Jesus do?
So three more points, sort of questions for Carissa and one for Alexandre. Very much enjoyed that, Carissa, your piece there on that. And I think this is an excellent project, it's a very interesting project. Just as sort of three points, I might have just got you wrong on this one, but you were comparing the warfare and the welfare state. And I wonder, to what extent, these sort of represent opposites and even sort of opposite discourses. To what extent actually they're the same ones? I'm thinking in terms of the way that talk about welfare reform, particularly in Britain, but in other countries too, was often linked to a sort of a war-fighting capability. The poor quality of recruits to the Boer War led to the kind of the Edwardian reforms, and similarly, seeing how unhealthy British recruits were comparison to, say, German ones led to a lot of the arguments for the welfare state. So maybe, there's the welfare state, warfare state. It's not so much that they're opposites, but that we've forgotten the warfare aspect of the welfare dialogue. Two other things, there's also more sort of questions. First one is, to what extent was the Home Office in some respects, a classic British thing of always fighting this war like the last one, thinking in terms of the First World War, and an overreacting to dissent because of the experience of the First World War. And finally, this is in the back of my mind, and annoyingly I've forgotten the names of both people, which is embarrassing. But if I remember rightly, that there were quite a number of high-profile British anarchists, particularly ones that sort of had fought in Spain or been connected with Arms for Spain, who actually collaborated with the war effort. And I'm thinking, and I've forgotten his name, it begins with a W, ends in a ham, but he wrote a book on strategy as well. A guy who helped organise...
Tom Winteringham.
Winteringham, exactly. And he was actually worked to create kind of the British resistance, which would be sort of in place if the Germans invaded. And he sort of worked with the government. And also the guy who designed the Mulberry Harbour, the engineer, was also, if I remember rightly, a political anarchist. And I'm wondering, was there a split, was there a serious split in the anarchist movement, like there was in many other left-wing movements in Britain at the time, between those who wanted to cooperate against fascism and those who wanted to oppose the warfare state? I have one for example, maybe I'll wait and see. That's enough questions probably from Tony Lee.
Do you want to answer that?
I will, otherwise I'll forget. Your first two points, I don't know. Yeah, I think I wasn't really seeking to make a contrast. I might have overstated the case just because that's the challenging bit. Although, it's just that we have forgotten, historiographies have forgotten the warfare bit. So I'm very happy with your contribution there. Absolutely, memories of World War I, especially the mutinous atmosphere around demobilisation is absolutely central to what's going on in this example. Both the anarchists and the government are playing with those memories in this. The anarchists are writing articles about, because they don't say anything that seditious directly in relation to the end of World War II. They talk a lot about mutinies after World War I, and that and that's. There's notes saying they're doing this very cleverly. They're not saying so. Yeah, the replaying of World War I is absolutely key. This is really interesting. High profile British anarchists. Wasn't Tom Winteringham kicked out of the Home Guard thing?
He was eventually.
That doesn't seem to me to be a collaboration with the state orientated war effort. I mean. That he sees that there might be some need for guerrilla tactics that he picks up in Spain, and he organises some kind of training, but that gets taken, as I understood it, that got taken out of the hands of the Spanish Republicans when it looked useful and potentially threatening. I mean, sort of thing that you'd expect, but that's my understanding of that bit of history. I don't think that there was a split in the anarchist movement over the war. There was a split on the left. So somebody like Alex Comfort and George Orwell have a big fight in the pages of Tribune about the kind of moral implications of pacifism. That if you're a pacifist, you might as well be a fascist. A really interesting discussion about how exactly we're defining fascism that goes on between them. And I wonder if maybe you're thinking also about a possible parallel with splits in the anarchist movement around World War One. You know, Kropotkin and his affiliates of Freedom Press do fall out about that, but I just don't detect that relation to World War Two. Yes, but thank you.
This Mulberry Harbour thing, by the way, I mean, who was that then?
I'm trying to remember the name. It was actually an engineer I met, and we were just talking about peaceful anarchism.
Yes, Google Mulberry Harbour.
I think you have to Google it. Right?
I think you're the next one.
A question for Alexander. Interesting ideas. Question about this. So you brought up the idea of Jesus on the cross sort of exposing the power of the state, which I think is something that's come up a couple of times in the conference. But as far as I understand the story goes, is that the people are accused of crucifying Jesus, and that Pontius Pilate gives the people the choice, should I free Barabbas, or do you want me to crucify Jesus? And they say, crucify him, crucify him. And it seems that early Christian martyrs would seem to fit that paradigm that you're talking about better than Jesus would. How would you, Christian martyrs?
I'd go back to what I hinted at, perhaps. The state isn't just some sort of abstract separate thing. It's people acting through the state. You know, it's still people manning it and doing what it does. And it's about changing everyone's attitudes precisely. So, yeah, the people crucified him in a sense, as did Pilate, and everyone did, actually, even the Jewish authorities then, because they all... couldn't bear the radicality of what you were saying. I don't know. But yeah, everyone was guilty in a sense. Except what it does do, though, is it exposes the violence of the state, or the violence that the state is or can perpetrate, kind of thing. Yeah, so yes, but that's the point in a sense. Alex.
Yeah, a couple of quick throwaway comments for Alex. You can throw them away if you like. That's all. I love the idea of a fringe Christian anarchist. I can't imagine being any more intellectually isolated. That is somewhere I want to go just to see what it's like. But Have you read Ward Churchill's Pacifism as Pathology? I think it's one of those conversation pieces that I think you need to engage with if you're going to try and convince normal anarchists that these are arguments worth dealing with. Because these debates have been had, and the problem with the turn the other cheek argument, and Ward Churchill brings it up very clearly, it basically ended up in the Holocaust, and that is not a position any anarchist wants to go back there. So I think that argument needs to be engaged with if you're going to convince people. And the second point you mentioned about the historiography of the wars of religion and the Christian anarchist interpretation is that I think that's a real contribution. I think that should be made a lot more of, because I think in terms of an IR audience, that sort of, even if it is just a reinterpretation without being revisionist, I think that would really appeal. And you could look at people like Benno Teschke, who's written about the myth of 1648, and sort of juxtapose his arguments about princely wars of basically property. Again, and juxtapose that with traditional Westphalian thing. Anyway, and then for Carissa, really interesting paper again. The militarism thing, I think I want to push you on how you understand that concept. And because there's a book by a guy called Bergham, and I'm obviously going to use this because on page one he says, it's called Militarism, History of a Concept, I think it's called. And on page one he says, militarism was coined by Proudhon. Okay, as a concept, it's born by anarchists. And the reason that Proudhon coins this term is he's basically looking at the way in which the French state is taking over the production of armaments, and how that is because of the way that the army has become so ensconced with the notion of citizenship and the state. Militarism signifies all that's wrong with the birth of the modern state. Okay, and so from the very outset, that concept's been at the heart of how people understand what the state is doing to society, because it's eroding all the social bonds and replacing them with military ones. And this was a real problem for him. And it's about that centralisation of control. And I think that sort of tying it in, using Bergham there might be a really good foil for sort of introducing the wider, bringing that anarchism in, like you said at the beginning, because you are focusing on the sort of state responses, but like to try and really get at the anarchist stuff. I think going back to Bergham first of all, then seeing the wider debates about militarism might really help there.
Well, yeah, but, yeah,
Firstly, a point on Tom Winteringham. I think we're pushing it, really, to call him an anarchist. Okay. He formed the Commonwealth Party during the Second World War and was actually elected to Parliament and didn't really lose his illusions in Stalin either. Question for Carissa. I wonder to what extent we can separate the treatment of the war commentary people from the context of the rest of the political fringe. We can use that term during the Second World War. So you have, for example, the law changed and all the black shirts, the British fascists arrested, interned on the Isle of Man. We have the Communist Party probably at its peak in British history and towards the end of the Second World War, contradictory attitude towards it. And you have small number of Trotskyists, people like Jock Gaston, being arrested for supporting industrial action. And, you know, is there anything unique about how the anarchists were treated, or was it just part of a wider strategy?
Yes and no. I mean, there's loads of interesting things about how all dissident groups were handled. I mean, the main difference up to this point is that the anarchists are ignored more than they ignored anyone. I mean, they really weren't seen as problematic. So, you know, the Daily Worker was censored at some point during the war. I mean, that's really the only example of direct censorship. Most of the ways they tried to censor groups was covertly, so as to avoid this kind of public cause. And there's some really interesting examples, like the example of the People's Convention, around which one of their big campaigns was allowing the people to use the deep underground shelters. You know, this kind of mythology we have about the people being allowed to use the underground for sheltering from bombs is one of those myths, because they had to fight for that. You know, then groups like the People's Convention on the left had to fight the state to allow them down the tubes. So I don't know, but nobody is addressed at the end of the war like this. That's what's so interesting. You know, partly it's how much less attention was paid to the anarchists than all the other groups during the war, but that the anarchists are unique in being handled at the end of the war like this, in a public trial. And so that's hence my argument, that there's something different about the nature of the anarchist challenge to the nature of the challenge posed by other groups on the left. So that's really, that is my point, that there is a difference. Does that...
Yeah, no, that absolutely.
Alexandra, just... a comment and a question. The comment was, and I said this to you at breakfast this morning, just to want to put a name out there, who's the sort of religious anarchist that seems to me to speak the most to sort of IR issues, and I'm surprised his name hasn't come up at all, is Martin Buber. And I think there's a lot of value running through Martin Buber and the way in which he deals with religion and anarchism alongside one another. To me, it's very interesting, it's very challenging. But, I mean, I know that's not your area, I just want to put a name out there. The other one was... just in terms of the authenticity issue, you talked about give to Caesar what is Caesar's. The one that jumps out at me is from the Sermon on the Mount, is the line, blessed are the meek. And there seems to be a difference there between the notion of turning the other cheek, which has a sort of subversive power in it, but blessed are the meek, there seems to be a sort of a withdrawal from any sort of subversive power in that, and a much more, not a pacifism, but a passiveness. And I wondered how that sort of is dealt with and fits in.
The honest answer is Christian anarchists don't talk much about the Beatitudes. There is one, but there's eight of them. That's not the only one. But there's also the Peacemaker, there's Businesses. It's not just being meek either. But yeah, there's something of that. But even in the turning of the cheek, there's something of that.
Yeah, no, sure.
I just want to sort of make sure that we don't call it completely passive. It's not. It is a form of reaction, turning the other cheek. It's one that accepts and takes the violence or absorbs it or whatever, but it's not completely passive. In a sense it is, but in the sense of not doing anything or being completely irrelevant, it's not. And Martin Buber, I need to look him up.
Of course, Buber is interesting because of Paulinism, and he He was a student of Landau, you know, director of Gustav Landau, who influenced the early radical version of the kibbutz. And of course also Buber with this idea of a binational state in Palestine. He's a very interesting man indeed. Anyway, yeah.
Okay, so I think beyond the atheist argument of evolution versus creationism, I really cannot see how you can reconcile Christianity and anarchism. And I'll just give three main reasons. First of all, the essence of anarchy for me, and as you mentioned it yourself, is the rejection of hierarchy and authority. And as Bakunin said, a God in heaven is the best, a boss in heaven is the best excuse for a boss on earth. So once you accept this frame thought that something is above you and determines your behavior, it's very hard to after that fight against states or any other power structures. The second thing is more individualistic level, and it's individual liberation, empowerment, and personal freedom. And Christianity does not exactly encourage equality towards women. It doesn't encourage gay rights or anything like this, which are really essential parts of self-liberation and of a freer society. And the third point, which is actually my main point, is it's very easy to pick passages that suit your ideology. So I can open any book I want, and I can, for example, Star Wars, and I can find amazing passages that I really agree with and really talk about anarchist thought, and then I will call myself a Star Wars anarchist. But you can't exactly do that. So you'd find good passages in any book you read. And really the main problem with that specific book or with religion in general, that it negates questioning, which I think is the essence of scientific thought and the essence of any type of scientific analysis, including social science analysis, and analysing your own theory. And to be able to really theorize about anarchism, you have to constantly question yourself. And by abiding with religion, it's very difficult to question yourself, because ultimately, religion doesn't allow you to question the ultimate question. You can't question the existence of God, so you have to accept things as if they aren't there.
Those are huge issues. But to start then, with Bakunin, I don't think that it has to follow that because there is an hierarchy in heaven, you have to accept the one here. I accept that, sure, to the extent that Christian anarchists want to obey God, then obviously they're obeying, and that's kind of troublesome. But their understanding is that must imply not obeying anyone else. Now, what God is not particularly clear, even there. He's certainly not, though, some sort of bearded man with testicles dictating things from up on a cloud in the way we portray him. If God is one, then we're all part. It's just a bit mysterious and complicated. So I'm not. I think we easily caricature religious belief or believe that the sort of idiots we see on TV sometimes are the typical Christian or the only way you can go about believing in God and that kind of stuff. And I think even there, contentiously perhaps, if you look back, even in the Middle Ages, some of the understandings of what God was or theology and all that are a lot richer and a lot more interesting and questioning, in fact. I don't think you have to sort of accept things necessarily unquestioningly. I know a lot of people, I don't know if I'm religious or not, I don't think I am, but I'm not sure. But I know many people who have reached religion not as a final answer. Torto perhaps takes it as a final answer, which is problematic. But actually, it's precisely through questioning that they considered it and took bits of it that they liked. Yes, if you look at the average, person who elected or helped elect Bush or whatever, they're not very convincing or fascinating. But that's not the only way you can go about interpreting Christianity. So, and yes, of course, you can open any book and pick bits you like. But I think, if you ask, for example, you ask any religious person, non-Christian religious person, what the defining characteristic of Christianity is as opposed to other religions, they'll usually mention love and that sort of turning of the other cheek business. Many will. It's pretty central to the message. I'm not just picking the bits I like. In fact, I'm even picking the two bits that I shouldn't like and trying to tell you why I think they're compatible. So, yes, in a sense, you can pick bits you like, and certainly in the Old Testament, but again, here, the New Testament is meant to sort of come after it. Now, and about empowerment, and yes, there isn't much about gay rights or women in
the
Bible.
There isn't much, there is against them.
But I don't think there is. I think the people who portray themselves as Christians are, but I don't buy their just. In the Old Testament, I think, I'm not even going to try and disagree with you. But I think the whole attitude of respect and, love is, I use that word in the broadest sense possible. If you love every human being, you cannot deny them of such basic rights as these campaigns are calling for. Now, the problem is also, the other one is slavery. That seems to be, you know, implicitly, if not tolerated, I mean, allowed to continue because, you know, slaves are being taught to remain slaves, but by Paul. But even here, it's again about not perhaps using force to try and overcome it, but to sort of forgive and love as much as you can. But you can't ask someone else to do that. It's about you doing it, and that's what that text asks you to do, I think. So to... Oh, there was a point. There was a final point to bring all that together, and it's gone. I think it's an Alex
question
thing.
Over here.
So there you go.
And Alex, when are we supposed to be stopping? I don't know.
Plus two.
Half past two, okay.
Yeah.
I originally formulated the question in my head, and part of it has already escaped me. But I can't remember exactly where it comes from because it came up in a conversation with a Christian anarchist friend of mine. But he was essentially talking about the passage of "turn the other cheek" and the possibility that it doesn't exactly mean what we think it means. And I can't remember whether he was saying it could possibly mean to turn your cheek into being hit as kind of a Gandhian expose yourself to violence to show, you know, the insanity of the situation kind of thing, or whether he was saying to turn your cheek the other direction so as to not violently oppose the violence, but to not embrace it, but to brush it, you know, to pull yourself away, but not violently do so.
Yeah, no, it's to do with the original Greek word in, you know, in the text, and not turning the other cheek. There is a whole series. I think what's he called? He's called Wink. I think one scholar talks about that and how it's what Jesus is talking about is more of a Gandhian kind of reaction. So it's not passive acceptance. It's not active resistance. But it is a different. I can't remember it. I'm not remembering the details of the argument. But he interprets the "don't do something," that's something as being "do not insurrect," no violent insurrection, something like that. That's the word that's being negated in the Greek and what Jesus is calling them not to do, but that doesn't mean accept everything, because that's also, you know, one of the rejected options. But yeah, I can't remember the details, but
the conclusion I got from the conversation I had was that our English translation of some of these passages is really, really weak.
Yeah, this is to Alexander as well. So I sort of agonised a lot over this paper, obviously because the belief systems vary, and I don't want to debate, well, we can't really debate on those issues because all we can do is disagree. But what we can debate and have discourse on is your attempt to use the Bible to justify an ethic of non-violence here. And so what animates my concern is, why do you need the Bible to justify a critique of Westphalia? To me, it's at best a distraction because we end up talking about antiquated, fairly contradictory passages in a 2,000-year-old document rather than talking about real oppression of the state today. And at worst, it sort of leaves in place an illusion that is equally oppressive and authoritarian as the state, but its power isn't based on a monopoly of violence, but it's based on the scripture's monopoly of ethics. Okay, and so we end up talking about, you know, on your sort of terms, a religious ethic. And so we have to then look for sort of counterexamples to that within the Bible. So my question, I guess, is God definitely kills, particularly in the Old Testament. And if we're made in his image, well, these men are, then we too can kill if it's just. And so the question goes to what is just in terms of how God kills in the Bible. And if you analyse it, it's always about questions of tyranny and oppression. And I'll give one example. Moses freeing the slaves. There's a passage where he kills Eglon. His name's Eglon, an Egyptian slaver, and he kills him quite brutally to free the Jews. So I was wondering, why can't we then use that as to fight against tyranny and oppression in the state?
Just on the minor thing you said before, I'm not saying you have to use the Bible to do this. You don't need the Bible, and I think what we've had so far yesterday and today are fascinating analyses that are very good as they are. You don't need the Bible, but if you're going to pick it in the way Christians claim to, then you've got to be honest about it. You know, they're not. Then, you know, that's that point, if you want. And that's what Christian anarchists say. They're addressing themselves to so-called Christians, saying, guys, if this is really what you claim to do, why? How can you even pretend to be a Christian, because it's clearly not what you're doing. Now, the Old Testament, New Testament thing, this is, I think, what I need to sort of cover in answering this. Even for the mainstream Christian tradition, but certainly for Christian anarchists, the New Testament supplements the Old. I mean, the Old Testament is the teaching of the Jews. The New Testament is what Jesus talks about. And he, there's that passage where he says, I haven't come to destroy the Old Law, but to fulfill it. Now, there's an interesting line of thinking about this, because it's about fulfilling the original intentions of the commandments, because precisely they have become... they've led to a society that's perhaps more and more violent, more and more distant from what the intention of those commandments were. That's how they will interpret the fulfilling, for example. But they certainly argue that it's what Jesus describes, talks about. It's the New Testament that matters, not the Old one. Precisely, and many actually Christian anarchists completely dislike the Old Testament. Some leave it and say, yeah, it's there, it's important, you know, but the New is more important. But most will, you know, dismiss the Old precisely because...
Okay, well,
it's
what about Revelations then, which has got a lot of killing and murder? It's obviously not a happy ending.
It does, but it's a story. I mean, it's full of images and funny animals who haven't, you know, it's a myth, and it's a myth also, by the way, in that apocalypse where you've got, again, God's kingdom kind of thing, and Babylon. And Babylon is politics. I mean, it's the current state. Is in sync with that interpretation. But sure, there is stuff. There is violence. Jesus comes back and uses a sword and all that. But it's full of symbolism. And it's a story. It's a symbolic kind of story. And as far as Christian anarchists are concerned, they do perhaps for the apocalypse particularly focus on the passages they like. And perhaps that's the one book in the New Testament where you can definitely say you're reading one thing, I can read others. But even there are things to be read along this line. Having said that, just final point. Perhaps all right. So I've given away the fact that perhaps they are selective in the reading of the apocalypse. Nevertheless, what matters is the teaching of that guy who you call God, or at least who you call very rational if you're Tolstoy. And that's the business of the Gospels. It's not what comes afterwards or the further interpretations from Paul, from others, from John, from whoever in the apocalypse. It's what he said, what he taught. And even there, of course, you can dispute the truth of it. It's a text, it's a set of texts, there's four accounts. Which one's right? That's why Tolstoy rewrites it. There's a Gospel according to Tolstoy out there. But you know, apocalypse is already an interpretation. I'll leave it there. There's a lot more here.
This is for Alexander. I was just wondering how, from a Christian anarchist perspective, you would respond to, not sure what I would call them, Christian groups. I'm thinking in particular in the U.S., there's groups that protest against abortion and recently actually violently killing in church, of all places, a doctor who did late-term abortions and then raised a defense very similar to the Raytheon defense. The killing was done to prevent greater harm. How do Christian anarchists respond to those groups, who at least in America would have the forefront of public attention about Christian, I don't even want to call it activism, but Christians doing things against what they perceive as wrong state action?
Call their bluff is what they do. There are quite a few Christian anarchists in the state, and they are getting exercised about things like that. And they say, these guys, you're not Christian. You're killing for a start. You're certainly not tolerant. You're certainly not loving. What you're claiming as the biblical truth comes straight from the Old Testament, with all the very problems that has, it's not a Christian thing to do. So that's what they're doing mostly. I don't know of them. I'm sure they've been going on some of those counter demos and all that, but of course, those idiots who go in and kill people in the church, you don't always know, so you can't necessarily go there and put your body in between them. But so they won't. They're not Christian. That's the point. That's what Christian anarchists say about it.
When people go near violence, non-violence, I'm with Jensen and Churchill and Galbraith on that one. But so that aside, I think what's really interesting for me is what's the source of an ethics, what's the source of authority, and it's it's something that I kind of talked about a little bit in my paper. And so for me as an anarchist, it's not God, it's not an essentially good human being. and it's not something that a completely autonomous individual can derive for themselves. It's something that which we collectively come to through an ethical position, but which we come to, and there's a huge amount of, there is a huge amount of individual agency in defining that, so your own authority. And so, yeah, one of the big problems I have is, does the ethics come from on high, and it does, I find that problematic. Also, sorry, just a minor thing, a big minor thing, is just original sin. You know, for me, it's
that's easy.
Loving the self. So, yeah.
Original sin is Augustine. It's another church theologian that comes later. It's not, okay. you will not find those two words to put together in the text. It's his interpretation of another very symbolic story in Genesis. So
okay.
That you can leave aside. The source of authority, yeah, of course. To the extent that some Christian anarchists take the Bible as it is, you know, and derive everything from there, they're not very questioning, or they've closed that questioning and they take it as an authority. And I've got problems with that too. Some Christian anarchists don't necessarily just take it like that. You know, they're still critical, and they actually, you can, I really think you can, and people don't always realize, I'm not saying most do, but you can engage with such traditions, traditions of the book even more critically than we think. Doesn't mean it's enough for an anarchist, I'm not saying it is. But by the way, all this, and the point of all this, and because now we're talking about Christian anarchism as an even possibility, or religion and anarchism, but my point, at least here today, is to say that if you are a so-called Christian, then your view of the world should be very different, and you don't believe in nation states and barriers of that sort. The church is meant to be universal; it's the community of human beings, and therefore, if you are going to call to say that you follow that tradition, then you should be behaving very differently, subverting this international order and the state that comes with it. That's the point.
I think we have time for two more questions. I'm just going to pick it because you haven't.
I was just going to say, I mean, coming off of your comment, there may be. I'll try to help you out, but this may be bad. Get you into more trouble. But there may be a way to communicate with IR or international political theory with Christian anarchism in terms of looking at the concept of cosmopolitanism. Which came up in terms of especially Kantian cosmopolitanism, which does have, I would say, like a bit of an anarchist strain to it. But in terms of coming up with a system of ethics for ethical action in the individual that is rooted in a metaphysical or some kind of theory of metaphysics. So in the Christian anarchist view, that metaphysics is bound up with a theological worldview that's derived from a text. For Kant, it's derived from human reason and transcendental ideals and tells us to treat each other as ends in ourselves and the categorical imperative and all that. And with the cynics and the stoics, it's bound up in metaphysical sort of claims or beliefs or whatever, or arguments as well. That seems to be something that an anarchist, even classical anarchists and so on, metaphysics gets sort of dropped out, right? And they relocate sources of ethics in experience, or I think you were taking kind of a Richard Rorty pragmatist view. So we decide what ethics are, not that there's anything wrong with that, right? We decide what ethics are in a community and so on. And that might actually be an interesting train of thought or something to kind of unpack. And then to take that into maybe the cosmopolitan versus communitarian debates in terms of how a Christian anarchist outlook can look. Especially with ethics that are based on kind of a universalism. There's this assumption that everyone can be a Christian. There's an assumption in Kant that everyone who has faculties of reasons can live by the categorical imperative. There's some assumptions in some anarchists.
Except
right?
Women. So.
Oh, yes, except women and also people who...
Color.
Like people who are laborers and so on. Because they don't own property. If you take that part out, just read the groundwork for the metaphysics of morals. It's not the metaphysics of morals or anything like that. Anyway, I'd say that's where Kant, being sort of a Prussian who never got out of Königsberg, invade some of his theories. But that might be kind of interesting. And then out of cosmopolitanism, this idea of universal ethical transcendence or something, you could even touch on like just war theory and things like that, which brings us back to the sort of, you know, some of the Gandhi-esque debates about what maybe the turn the other cheek passage means in terms of international conflict or something like that, right? An ethic of just war. Yeah.
No, thanks. I mean, this is something I need to look up. But it does allow me to make this brief point, which is that I don't think you can have a position that doesn't have some sort of implicit assumed kind of metaphysics, or at least has, you know, and that's the thing. All right, Christians are very exposed. Their metaphysics are exposed because they, you know, that's what
right.
they do.
You
but
know,
ultimately,
yeah.
we've all got some sort of way of trying to answer these ultimate concerns and big questions. And yeah, we all do, and perhaps we don't talk about it. Anyway, yeah.
If you can ask your question in 10 seconds,
yeah, I can do it very short. Yeah, it's just sort of thought exercise and being sort of devil's advocate. I was thinking sort of how I would answer all these questions as well, and I was sort of following on from what you said on that. Was like I can think maybe of possibly two arguments you might use in terms of saying, you know, the link between Christianity and anarchism, and sort of answering your point. None of which I'm willing to stand by, but I thought I'd throw them out. One is seeing the Christian idea of freedom as being the basis of the modern idea which informs anarchism. In the sense that, you know, the ancient idea of freedom is not our idea. It doesn't have free will. It's actually quite nasty. And so, in that sense, Christianity, therefore, you know, can be seen as the origins of our kind of concept of freedom, which leads to anarchism. And the other one was a kind of reversal of the Nietzschean position that in the Gay Science that you can argue that, so even if you don't believe in God, you could maybe argue that that the ethics of anarchism, despite, you know, Kropotkin's very good book on ethics, is at its base, and however it's justified, is actually based upon a Christian moral code. Like I said, I'm not willing to stand by those, but there might be ways that you could actually argue that Christian anarchism actually is central to kind of anarchism.
There's a lot of evidence to support both those positions by reading anything by Proudhon.
Organizer of this wonderful symposium, a man who likes Proudhon. It's a good point to stop at. Well, I'd like to thank the speakers, and we should all thank the speakers. Appraisal, because I think we've had very good audience. Alex, who's done his wonderful job of organizing, is that he really is the cultural entrepreneur of British academic.
Couldn't have done it without you guys coming here.
Thanks. That's it.
Alrighty.